Welcome back to another episode of Finding Your Identity in Your Autism Journey. I'm your host, Ruth Castle, and today's conversation is one I have been holding space for, Becoming After the Breaking, where we're diving into a raw and real transformation that happens when life as we knew it falls apart, after the diagnosis, after the grief, after the letting go of who you thought you had to be. This isn't about fixing or rushing to heal, or it's about honoring the sacred pauses between breaks and becoming. Joining me today is someone I deeply respect, Carla Chinning, founder of Empathy Autism California, Inc., and the voices of Beyond the Spectrum. She is a fierce advocate, a fellow autism mom, and someone who has walked through fire and come out with a purpose. Together, we're opening up about identity, faith, and what it really means to find strength on the other side of surrender. Whether you are in the middle of your own breaking point or still picking up the pieces, I want you to know you are not alone. Let's get into it. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Ruth, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes. So walk, us through some of these areas that how you got started. What was the moment or realization that shifted your work?
To be honest with you, it started actually before my son. I'm a sibling of my brother. He has a diagnosis. For his privacy, I won't disclose it, but he does have a diagnosis. So I grew up in already that environment of SIV caregiving. And then fast forward, when I received the diagnosis from my son. I think that's where it really shifted for me, especially because I felt like I had to convince people of the diagnosis. I have a background in psychology, so I had already seen the signs. When we went to the doctor, my husband and I had already taken him because there's this group on Facebook that's local here. And they had mentioned that specific doctor that I was going to go see, the child psychologist that I was going to go see. And how long she took to give those diagnosis letters. And I was like, I refuse to wait 6 months to a year to get a diagnosis letter. So what I did is I booked the occupational therapist, the speech therapist, the neurologist, the genetics doctor, all to point out that it was autism. So when I went to her appointment, I created a list of behaviors. I created had already a packet of all the results from the other specialists. And I take it to her office and she looks at me and she's like, are you a doctor? Are you a teacher? And I'm like, no, I'm a concerned parent, ma'am. That's what we have to do. And she's like, well, you'll have to see all these specialists. I'm like, no, actually I don't. I already saw them and they all point out to autism.
Yeah.
I'm just here for the letter at this point because I need to get him started like ASAP on different therapies and things that need to get implemented for him. So early intervention. And mind you, I had just had my daughter 5 days before that diagnosis. So I was probably going through postpartum depression myself.
Yes.
So a lot of emotions were happening. And I think the diagnosis for autism hit me, obviously, because even though you know it, it becomes real when they give you that paper.
Mm-hmm.
But then on top of that, they added cognitive delay. That one I wasn't expecting. And, I know a lot of parents know when they go get these assessments done, it's not sugarcoated. They literally tell you in numbers, digits, and every kind of way, graph, how much of a deficit your child has.
Yes.
And it hits you like a brick, because at that point, though, I knew he was going to, he was autistic. When they gave me the cognitive delay, she also started stating things that he might not possibly be able to do. And that's like, I think where I was like, oh, my God, this is our new reality.
Yes.
And the grieving then starts kicking in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the having to fight. And I remember we went to the hospital that day, coming out of the hospital with my son, and my daughter stayed at home because she was a baby. I didn't want to bring her into the hospital. My mom cared for her, but I could barely walk at that point still. Walking down, and I'm like, a million things are going through my head. My husband, he sees that I'm like close to like breaking down in the hallway of the hospital. We see of some friends there that they were going to their prenatal appointment. And they stop us. And I'm like, the last thing I wanted to do is talk to people at that point in time. You know, I just wanted to go to the car, cry, you know, and like hug my kid and just say, everything's going to be okay. We're going to get through this, you know, pray and, you know, just try to recoup as much faith as possible, you know, to kind of keep me strong through the process. And they stop as they start saying, oh, a lot of kids are getting misdiagnosed, you know, and I clearly see the signs he's autistic, but, you know, I understand where they were coming from. They're kind people. So I'm like, oh yeah, thank you. You know, I couldn't get out of there fast enough. We go in the car and I just remember my husband, like, he didn't cry. He was just there to be that, you know, solid person for me. And yeah, at that point, I just let it out. You know, when I got home, I think it was probably a week where I would at times, because I didn't want Adrian or my husband to see me crying randomly, I would sometimes go into the garage, pretend like I was getting something at the garage and just cry. And then, I don't know about you, but for me, like, I started getting all hyper-focused.
Yes, I can relate to that.
Reading books, looking through every possible autism website. You know, I remember I read this article on 10 things an autistic person wants you to know about autism. And one of them was like, the noises, you know, how the noises are so piercing to my ears. And all I could think about was prior incidents and events where we would attend family events and, you know, family would make fun of my son crying over music, thinking it was funny. But in my heart, at that point, I was aching because I knew the reality. He was in pain and I wasn't there to really
save him from that.
Understand and save him from that. I mean, I would try to put stuff around and they would make fun of me and I don't care. I'm a mama bear, regardless of whatever anyone thinks. So I would put like classical music and then like the headphones and the blankets around the head because I knew the noise bothered him. But at that point, it almost also gave me peace of mind that I knew I wasn't crazy, that I knew when something was off, you know, now at least I know what path to kind of go in to try to get him those services and that help. Hopefully get the family to empathize.
Yes.
And to be supportive, you know, so we could move forward from that diagnosis.
Yeah. And, you know, I think maybe even, would you say being a sibling kind of helped you prepare, you know, to handle some of the things that you now are experiencing with your child?
Yes, in the sense, I think it made me very resilient. I mean, I have a pretty strong background. Like, I've been through a lot of stuff. From a personal standpoint, but then on top of that, seeing my mother and everything she had to go through with my son, I mean, with my brother. And on top of that, for me to have to step in and, you know, I'm in the process of writing a book about this and just basically the impact that a diagnosis can have on the whole family.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's where it truly hit me the most. Because I was expected to be the straight A student. I was expected to be the one. And even if they didn't say it, you could see it. I mean, I'm a very empathetic individual. And I absorb people's energy and how they're feeling. And I am always the comforter. I'm not necessarily the yes person because I'm not. But I will try, especially with my mother and my father. And obviously at that time, my brother and all that. I would always be the one that would comfort and try to find sort of a solution for them and keep them at peace.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, it created, I think, a certain level of resiliency in me that if I didn't have that otherwise, it would have been very hard for me to process a lot of things that I'm even currently going through with my son and our family dynamics, you know? So yeah, I truly think that was a huge key point for us.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned too, you know, and not everybody's fortunate, and I have this too, you know, having that solid rock your husband to be there with you, it definitely does help, because sometimes when we're in mommy bear mode, it can go to extreme into some aspects, like definitely the research part. I definitely fell into that research because we're very similar, I feel like, in that way. I fell into the research holes, if you want to say, like rabbit holes of all kinds of things, but I still do it. But I process the information a little bit differently, not in a panic process, because that's what I was doing before.
Yeah, I agree. Like, my husband, yeah, definitely. I can honestly say, for the most part, he's always been a supportive individual. As far as understanding the diagnosis, I think it took him a little bit longer. And understanding his role with Adrian and being that father for Adrian, not only in the sense of provider, but also being a sense of understanding how to connect with him. Even though, because my son, he is partially verbal, but it's very hard to get through to him unless you're literally talking about the pictures he's looking at. Or so I had to have that serious conversation with my husband and say, hey, at one point, you're going to be the one that he's going to completely look up to. Mm-hmm. You have to be the one that he can count on. And if you cannot find it in you to connect with him, then maybe at this point in time, it's best for us to see what we're going to do with our marriage. Because I need someone that's present, that's here, and that's willing to put in the work as much as I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Because this is not a one team player, you know, game. We need the whole family in it.
Yes.
And you're part of family. So at that point, I think, as of, I would say right now my son's 11, I think around the age of 7 or 8, that's when I had that strong conversation with him. He's always been a great father, but it was very, he could sit on one end on the couch and my son on the other end of the couch, and they could sit there for hours not talking, not engaging. And I didn't want that for my son. I don't know about you, but I know I lost sleep thinking to myself, like, what is my son going to do if I'm no longer here? Who is he going to connect with? You know, and I think as mothers, I also had to step back and see myself in a mirror and say, hey, what am I doing? And how can I make it honestly easier for my husband, for him to be sincere with me?
Yes.
And say, hey, when I try to approach him, maybe you're too much mama bear. Maybe you have to let go a little bit. And if you let go a little bit, I can step in and be more of that support for him. You know, and it's taken a while. Like, for example, my son now, he's 11. He's a big, big bear. Big guy. And I'm like, can I get a hug? He's like, no, daddy gives me hugs, you know, and it hurts because I'm like, I'm mommy, you yeah. know, like, what are you talking about? But a part of me, I know it's part of the process. It's part of him getting closer to his father, which is the initial, my initial goal, you know, and it, a part of me, yeah, it hurts my little mommy ego, but ultimately, the bigger picture is he doesn't feel like I'm the only person he can go to now.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful feeling. And, you know, it's allowed me to now expand to do other things myself, for myself and for my daughter as well. Mm-hmm. So we can build more as a family.
Yeah, I like that. And, you know, I had to have a talk like that with my husband, but I've been pushing my husband to do more things with my son, because he's also, my son is minimally verbal. He also has apraxia. So it makes it harder, not only apraxic of speech, he has apraxic of whole body. So it makes it a little bit harder to understand what he's trying to convey. And my husband's been doing really well with that now that he sees that the things that I have been doing with him is, you know, like doing the parkour and doing spelling to communicate and doing these things, he's getting a lot more motor function, more purposeful motor. And my husband's able to connect with him more, where he has before, he didn't really know like why certain things were happening. But I'm like, if you keep interacting with him on his level, on what he needs, he'll start to integrate and do more with you. And that I'm starting to see that. And it's so beautiful, because like it's so interesting, when my husband comes home, he wants to take him to his room, he grabs him by the hand and he wants him to play with him on his trampoline and all this stuff, you know. And I'm like, that's what he needs, and he's 7 right now, you know, but he needed that. But then before, my husband, much like your husband, was sitting, you know, like, oh, he's doing his thing over there, I'll do my thing over here, we're in the same room. I'm like, no, he needs interaction with you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm seeing that.
they're boys and they have to learn from daddy, you know, a lot of how to be a man.
Yes.
You know, even if it looks different, it's still the same process. It's still the same biological need, I feel.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, it's beautiful that your husband is realizing that. It was around the same time for my husband with my son. And I think honestly, the biggest eye opener is we went to a family function. And that's when I had to have that talk with him. I saw him engaging with my nephew that's the same age as my son. And he was talking about basketball and he was like so excited. And I understand from a human element, I understand. And he talks about it in the podcast we created. You know, he was my first guest. And he talks about how hard it was for him to acknowledge the diagnosis, because then at that point he had to acknowledge what he had lost as a father. But he also had to realize what he was gaining, you know, with Adrian the way he is and the amount of innocence that's still in him. Like, he's not a bratty teenager, you know, that gives us attitude. You know, he's a sweet boy, you know, and now he's embracing that. And that's, I think, when I was, you know, Mama Bear really kicked in. Like, part of me was, my blood was boiling, not because he was talking to my nephew, you know, nothing against the nephew, but just because, like, I create for that type of interaction for that him to have with my son.
Yes.
You know, and for him to engage with my son. And I understand my son can't sit there and talk stats of basketball or football. But at the same time, you need to find a way to engage. And now they have their little inside jokes and they laugh at random things that I don't even know what they're laughing at, you know? And it, you know, it's so beautiful to see, you know, like, I think that's every mom's dream. And like you said, not everyone is as blessed to be able to have that with their child. Mm-hmm. Because the diagnosis does affect a lot of marriages out there.
Yes.
You know, a lot of looking in the mirror a lot as humans.
Yes.
When we have that diagnosis, you know, and acknowledging where we're overstepping with the significant other, where they're overstepping, how to have that conversation and transparency.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring that up because I just read a stat that there was only 19% of men will stay in a relationship with a special needs child.
Yeah.
And that stat is horrible.
Scary.
You know,
it's a scary stat, you know, that was, like I said, a big reason why I'm trying to publish this book on how diagnoses do affect. And also from a sibling standpoint.
Yes.
You know, it causes a lot of aftermath effects. Mm-hmm. on that sibling. And then with marriages, you know, we have, through Empathy for Autism, the organization I founded, we try to provide a support group, a virtual support group for men, you know, so because we do understand that a lot of support groups out there are mixed.
Yes.
And sometimes men have a hard time being vulnerable and letting out what they really feel because there's always a woman present in the chat or in the group. So I created that space, you know.
And that is amazing. I'm definitely want to put that in the show notes as well, a link to that, so my listeners can actually do that. And the dads will feel free and have a space to go to, you know. Yeah. And since it's virtual, you know, don't have to go in person. They can do it on their phone. They can do it anywhere. They don't have to be, you know, I'm in Florida and you're in California. That makes it, yeah. But they're still experiencing a lot of the things that is, and can talk about it in a safe, open place, maybe get ideas from one another.
Yeah. And like what my husband has mentioned, because we just launched this organization in February, March. So today actually is session number two of the support group.
Okay.
So the second time that they join. And my husband, the first time, I'm not even going to lie, like, he came out almost in tears. He's like, I didn't realize I needed this until I was there.
Yeah.
You know, just to have other dads to talk about, our, not necessarily per se our feelings, but just everything that we go through and even the guilt we feel or the denial or the overwhelming nature that, or the fact that we feel guilt for taking care of ourselves or we have to be the strong ones all the time and not really dissect into our own feelings of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and shut down a lot of the times with the family.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I was glad to see that the purpose behind it is working. You know, I have other support groups for our mamas and then for our Hispanic community out here in California, because we're a big Hispanic community. But yeah, that was a big reason, you know, I saw it with my husband. He needed that.
Yeah. And, I hosted a round table of dads, and I think their voices are definitely needed to be heard. And that one really resonated with a lot of people. And then this weekend, we're having a Father's Day. I didn't want to do it on Father's Day because there's so many things going on, but we're having a Father's Day luncheon this coming weekend. And it'll make it easier for the dads because they're not really recognized too much, you know? And I just wanted them to have a space where they can, get to know other dads and try to create that out here too. Because sometimes they might just need a. And at the dads' roundtable, they all swapped numbers so they could talk to one another, which, and they have been. And that's nice. That's what you need. They need each other because they could ask questions, what's going on, that maybe their friends that don't have children on the spectrum, they couldn't talk to really about, you know?
I mean, it happens to us as women, to be honest with you. Like, I had certain set of female friends that I no longer, they're good acquaintances, but sometimes it's hard to connect with them because for us, if my kiddo is able to go to the park with no meltdowns, that's like an achievement in itself.
Yes.
And they look at me all like, what is going on? Are you kidding me? You know? And I like, I mean, I have other friends that don't have neurodivergent children, but I can say I can relate more with those that do because they understand. Like, if my kid starts having a meltdown, he's not already stared at and looked at, you
Exactly.
know, or if we can't attend a birthday party of their own kiddo, we're not immediately put in the list to not invite again, you know, because we couldn't make it, because they understand that it's not as easy for us to carry a 220-pound baby
Yeah.
to a party that he might not want to be in because it's too hot and he'll be sweating and he doesn't like to be in the sun, you know,
Yeah.
like little things like that. So same thing goes for men. Like, I've talked to my husband and he has his guy friends, but he's like, sometimes I do want to talk about certain things that I'm going through with Adrian that I know I'm either going to come off as too much for my friends that don't have kids that are autistic or with neurodivergence, or I'm gonna come off, or they might not even listen to me, and I just feel like, you know,
Yeah.
I'm just there and just going, like, all I can talk about is basketball with them, or, you know, who the Steelers picked up, you know, or whatever the
Yeah.
case. So, yeah,
You know,
definitely.
that, and that's hard. Just like what you said, they're grieving too. They're grieving like how we grieved about we had an image and they're doing the same thing. You got to give yourself permission to grieve. How did you get through that permit? How did you give yourself that permission?
To be honest with you, I gave myself that permission because I knew if I wasn't going to be 100% there mentally, I wasn't going to be able to take care of whatever I needed to take care of. And at that time, though my husband was there, he was consumed by work. So to kind of process his own way, in his own way. And he doesn't, when he's going through things, he shuts down. He's very quiet and very to himself. Though it seems very stoic, you know, and like he's trying to just take care of the family and keep in all that. At the same time, I needed someone to cry with me. And sometimes I didn't get that, you know, so I had to do it on my own. Like I said, sometimes hiding myself while the kids were, you know, sleeping while Adrian was sleeping, my husband at work, I would just let it out. And you know, and then from that point forward, you just start seeing, kind of making lemonades out of the lemons that are given to you. You know, you just make the best out of it. You try to be the best advocate. Then my daughter, you know, she was born. I even sometimes carry still that guilt. You know, when my son was little, you know, I had at least a 1 to 2 years solid where I would take him almost every day to the park. And enjoy, even when I was pregnant with my daughter, and enjoy him almost every day at the park and, you know, outings with him. And then I get the diagnosis 5 days after I have her. So because I got on it, within a month, he already started ABA therapy. And it was ABA therapy, like 6 hours a day therapy, you know, and then from there, occupational, driving to occupational, and then speech. So my daughter, basically, the first couple years of her life was running around in therapies. And being part of that therapy, like sibling play, parallel play, but not really, I didn't get a chance to really take her out to the park, just her and I, you know. Till this day, I still carry a little bit of that guilt, you know, but it was what I had to do at that time, you know. So now that, we're a little bit more past that, and now he's in a non-public school and he's there, a good portion of the day because we take him there an hour and a half, then an hour and a half back, and then everything with that. Like summer, I told my daughter, I won't put you in any camp or anything. We'll just, you get to spend time with mom. So I get to take her to museums. I get to spend time with her. I get to kind of like give her that time she deserves,
Yeah.
So I think back to your question, how did I make myself grieve? I think as a mom, you just have to give yourself that permission and stop comparing, and stop kind of reminiscing on what the could have been. To not hold you back and see more of what can be and what can happen and focus on that instead and just take that positive approach. Though it's not going to be as easy every day. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, how is today going to look like? Just taking one day by at a time and then just staying as positive as possible, I think, in all this. And like you said, a lot of the times maintaining that faith.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, making sure that you take the time, like how you're doing with your daughter too. And then you also said, having that mom guilt when I don't have any other children, would like to have more. But if that comes, I'm always thinking, I'm like, I'm always doing all this stuff for my son. How is that going to look like for my other child? And I was like, well, you can't go back there because you don't know what that other child's going to be like. So stop reminiscing and thinking about things that aren't real. That's what I keep telling myself too. And then, maybe she had a great impactful experience playing parallel play. She didn't have the park, but she didn't ha know what the park was like. I try to think of it in that aspect too.
Yeah, like for us, we fixed up the backyard at that house we used to live, and we made it basically a really nice backyard for them. So they had like she's been blessed, and I've taken them to like summers to the zoo safari, especially when Adrian was smaller. I could travel with him and my daughter by ourselves. Now, as a big guy that he is, I have to have my husband with me because he is level 3 more severe autistic, so he had can have a little bit of the explosive meltdowns, which is now kind of the new challenge we have as a family. So what I do now, because a lot of the times when we do go out, we have to accommodate a lot of things for Adrian, from where we go eat to how long we can drive to how long we can stay there. Sometimes she's happy because she didn't even probably want to leave the house. So when we're not there for that long, she's okay with that. But if it was a preferred place for her, it puts us in a situation where like, sweetheart, we'll bring you back here, just us three. So what I've done is here in California, we have some services called respite hours given to us by Inland Regional Center based on my son's needs. So with that, what I do is I bring in my mom and she cares for Adrian. So we could take her at least once a month out to wherever she wants, whether it's a museum, the zoo, or just a park, something simple, or just, she loves ramen and dumplings, just to go eat her food in peace without having to worry about certain meltdowns. We've had episodes where I can't blame her for feeling embarrassed, like my son, he finds it funny sometimes to disrobe, and this is a big guy. So we're like, no, sweetheart, they're gonna call the cops. I'm hugging him from the front, my husband from the back, and I'm like, Sophie, give me his clothes. And this is a public park by the beach where there's a lot of people. So she's like, oh my God, I can't believe he's doing this. But I can't be mad at her. She's just a 9-year-old that is barely entering that teenage year of embarrassment. She's not understanding what's really happening with brother as much as I can under explain to her. She's autistic, but because she's so high functioning and she's actually on the opposite end, like super gifted and rational about everything that she does, it's even harder for her to understand why he would do certain things. So she's like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. I'm so ready to go already. I'm like, relax. At one point I have to like laugh and say, you gotta laugh about it. We got him to put his clothes back on. Look at him. He's having a la laughter attack because he saw us panicking. We'll go get ice cream after this, it's okay to feel what you feel, but you don't have to, let it consume you emotionally because this is our reality. This is what it is. So, yeah.
I will tell you too, there's a book that I read, and I think you might find it useful. The book is called Where the Wild Things. And it is about two psychologists, two male psychologists, wrote this book about boys. And every 3 years, they get different types of testosterone from the age of three, from 0 to 26. So every 3 years, they get new types of testosterone. And there's physical milestones that have to happen during these times. And I bring it up because since I've read this book, I have now, in each chapter, there's a marker to help you to understand what testosterone that they're in and help them get into that. And it's been very helpful for for and I. Like, I'm like, oh, he's experiencing this right now. So how can I help him? Even though, he's nonverbal, even though he still has challenges with his autism and his apraxia, like, how can I help him on the biological level meet some of these milestones that the book talked about? And I'm referencing back to this book constantly because it has helped. It's helped me with his regulation. It's helped me with so many different aspects of it. And it's not even for autism. It's just talking about men and their testosterone in general. I have learned stuff about my dad through that book, about my husband. I'm like, oh my gosh, I think you guys missed some testosterone milestones. And at the end of the book, it talks about how you can catch them up if they did miss them. There's some things in there. So I've been doing some of them even on my husband, and it's been kind of interesting.
You need to text me the name of that book. I'm definitely gonna look for
I
to
definitely
read.
will. I'll send it to you.
Oh, they already think we know everything, so I'm like,
But
give us rules.
it was written by two male psychologists, and they talk about it, and it is a very interesting book. Very, very interesting.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm always up for a good book, definitely. Oh my goodness, that would be funny. I'd be like, my husband would be like, how did you know that?
Yeah.
How did you feeling that?
Like, wow. And then they talk about something happens when they turn 60.
Wow.
Well, I'm like, okay, I don't need that part yet. Maybe for my dad, but I'm like, I'm just focusing on my son and my husband right now.
Definitely. No, that's awesome. I'd definitely be looking forward to reading that book. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Oh my
I'll also
goodness. But
post that
yeah.
in the show notes too, guys. It's an interesting read. If you have boys or men in your life, that book, you need to read it. It's eye-opening.
Especially being women trying to understand them.
Yeah, and what is that movie where the guy was like thinking he could hear women talk like their thoughts? Was Mel Gibson, I think.
Mel Gibson,
Yeah,
yeah.
what women
Hearing
want.
what women want
And the
or what women think or something like that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
now it's just reversed.
My goodness. But it is a lot of the times you just have to sit there and it's almost like mind reading, like, or depict, like, deciphering the behaviors
Yes.
of your kid. Like, I can't tell you how many times I felt like an Inspector Gadget trying to figure out and find solutions to certain things and certain situations that were causing a possible meltdown. So,
So what surprised you the most about your personal growth throughout this journey that you've been on?
honestly, I would have to say since I received the diagnosis with Adrian and then having to fight to get a diagnosis for Sophia because girls are not as easily diagnosed because they're great at masking and their characteristics are very different to a boy's characteristics with autism. It was a lot more fighting. And the only reason why I honestly got a diagnosis for her was because it does help with, like I mentioned, she's gifted. So with her having a diagnosis, I can implement because she's so capable academically. It was very hard to prove my point with an IEP or 504. So it really kind of helped. So now they give her harder work to keep her busy and not be mischievous in class because she's bored, or talking to everyone, and trying to get to know everyone in the classroom. Because that's another thing they said, oh, well, she is social. I'm like, one thing is knowing how to talk to people and speak and be eloquent. Another thing is actually creating those friendships and those relationships that are a little bit deeper.
Yes.
So that's, she's not there yet. You know, she comes home and I'm like, do you have any friends? You know, because we moved her schools. And she's like, no, those are acquaintances. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, you were playing. They're acquaintances, Mom. I can't share my life with them. And I'm like, oh my God, kid, how old are you? Are you like 60 or 9? You know? And that's how she was able to get us to buy her a dog. She's like, I need a soulmate. I feel alone. And I'm like, good at it.
I love that.
You know, so with that being said, just having to, honestly, the journey with my kids has built my character and who I've become as a woman, who I try to become better as an individual. And being so immersed in the autism community for now, I would say for over 9, 10 years, learning so much and not wanting to for other families to have to go through the same things I went through. Okay. And the same challenges I went through, if I can, you know, with creating the organization, the nonprofit that I did, it was to kind of provide that additional training for our families. You know, initially I was going to do the advocacy. I started it as a soul prop advocacy business, but I attended this one conference and it was in an underserved community of Hispanic individuals and they're living paycheck to paycheck. How can I expect them to pay me?
Yeah.
And for them to not have them, and because of that, not give them the knowledge that they needed. So yeah. I said, I have to find a different way to be able to get these services to underserved communities, whether it's the Hispanic community, the Black community, and other communities that are, there's certain desert areas that are like an hour away and a half from my house, but that don't get any services or any information, any resources out there. Or they don't know any better. They don't know about their children's rights in the school district setting. Doing that, giving them that sense of community and support through the support groups, you know. Yeah. And my platform, it's very parent-based. So I invite a lot of parents to share their stories, a lot of moms, a lot of dads to share their stories, because I feel a lot of the platforms, which I do invite a couple professionals here and there, but for the most part, it's for them to share the story and have that platform for parents, because a lot of the times many platforms are given to professionals and not many are given to parents where we're in the thick of it. We're the ones that are living it. And I think very little does our voice get heard.
Yes.
Because we don't have X, Y, and Z acronyms. So, like I said, I am getting my master's and stuff. I don't base all that I know, honestly, on a book that I read. I base it based upon life experiences, because sometimes you need to go through it to really create that, hence name of our organization, empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked for certain organizations where I've worked with people that don't have kids, you know, and their perspective on families that need these services were a little bit mind-boggling for me, you know, too. I almost felt like I was selling out being one of a service coordinator, you know, because I'm one of those families. And sometimes, you know, though they're great, there's some great service coordinators, there were some that I'm like, no, you did not just say that.
Yeah.
So, but I would have to keep it in because I wanted to keep my job, you know?
Yes.
So you just find yourself in those inner struggles, you know? And I think I've been blessed enough to be very tech savvy where I've been able to start this nonprofit, honestly, on my own budget, because right now I haven't applied for any grants of any kind, and just be able to launch my own website, figure out all the technology behind the podcasting. Mm-hmm. Figure out the networking aspects. I did all the graphic design and all the marketing for when I do events in the community, all the flyers, you know. So in that sense, I'm blessed that my skills have brought me to this place to now see not necessarily all the negative that comes with the autism, because we can't sugarcoat things. It's challenging. It's a challenging place to be at, you know. It's not fun as a parent to see your child go through anxiety spurs, you know, and for you to be like, okay, you know, it's really, you know, it takes a toll on us as parents.
It does take a toll. And I love how you're leading it. And I feel like, you know, you're out there doing what I'm out here doing in Florida, you know, and I'm taking a charge here and we need that. You know, I do charge for my services. I don't have not a nonprofit, but I do offer free too. And classes. Once a month, we have a topic and we talk about them. And then I do individual like Zoom meetings and things like that. So because we have to come together as a community. We're all going through something. Mm-hmm. And I love mom leaders. You know, I love that we are leading that, changing the narrative. The more that we come together, the more that we charge and move forward together.
I couldn't agree more with you. And honestly, the whole charging for your services, I have an advocate. You know, I this advocate has been amazing. She's been honestly godsend. And she was amazing too, because she didn't just charge me and did the work. She made me learn the work.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can help other families. I don't per se advocate. I do IEP trainings. And if they ask me questions, I will provide. But honestly, advocating takes a lot of your time. It's not easy. It's not easy. It's not easy making that time. And honestly, it's hard when we're parents with special needs kids to be doing all this free of our time. You know, it's not easy, because we too have responsibilities financially and with time with our children. And as it is, we split ourselves in 30 different pieces.
Yes.
So I don't frown upon my advocate charging me whenever, if it, you know, if it's a basic IEP, I'm like, do you want to just log in? And honestly, why I asked her to come to is I see it as an insurance policy.
Yes.
Because my husband doesn't attend the IEPs. I say, if I'm ever sick or God forbid, I'm no longer here, I want her to attend the IEPs with my husband. So she basically takes over and Adrian doesn't lose any services based mm-hmm. upon me not being there to advocate for him. My husband exactly. would just be basically the person that just shows up, logs in their name, says yes to everything my advocate says yes to, you know? That's mm-hmm. the only reason right now at this current time she goes with me to these IEPs. And I occasionally, if I struggle with certain things, you know, because like I said, my son is very severe. If I'm struggling with something with the school districts or even the non-public in things that they might need additional, and I need to get additional, let's say, assessments for my son, she guides me a little bit more to know exactly what specific assessments are needed based on that need in itself. So,
yes.
But I, you know, you got to be a sponge. I pick up all this information. So it's amazing that you do it, whether you charge or not. It's amazing. To be honest with you, I don't fully go and advocate for these parents. I allow them to call me, you know, and we occasionally talk about certain IEPs, but I don't act as a representative to them, because this is about a community and building that nonprofit. And like I said,
yes,
our time is also valuable. As moms, as women. So I don't see anything wrong with that, to be honest with you, you know, and it's
yeah.
amazing the fact that you do a lot of stuff that it is for free, you know, and you're doing that for the community without having a nonprofit. You know, I'm barely starting mine. And like I said, a lot of this is, I call it on a free 99 time, but it's fine. And I'm happy to do it because I love my community. But in the long term, you can't work 40 hours for free, you know? It's not feasible.
Yeah, yeah. And I do have other ways that we can, you know, I can get other recuperation of, like, monetary means, if that makes sense. But majority, in the beginning, you know, that's how I started, and because I was doing it for my own and everything. But I love that teaching them is the important piece, because that's what I try to do too. But sometimes they need, like you said, that insurance policy. Don't go it alone. I always tell them, it's like, you know, if you can't hire me, hire someone else, please, you know, or take someone, like someone with you. Make sure you take notes, ask questions, you know, at least do something, because you shouldn't go it in alone, because sometimes, like you said, that insurance policy of them actually having someone with them does help. You know,
yeah, it does. And then just letting them know of their basic, like, rights, you know, like you can record, you know that, right? Just give them 24-hour notice and you can record your IEP. And then, like I mentioned here in this community out here, there's a lot of Hispanics and some of them don't speak English.
Yes.
Or not only Hispanic, you know, there's a large Asian community. So just knowing that they can get an interpreter. Paid for by the
yes.
district, their IEPs translated. You know, and understanding their laws so they can be active participants to their child's IEP and not feel lost, confused, not feel forced to sign the document before, you know, they
mm-hmm.
read it. I always tell my parents, I'm like, make sure you take it home and read it when you're not upset, when your blood's not boiling, when you're cool-minded, you know,
mm-hmm.
so you can actually digest the information correctly and make sure you know what you're signing, you know, because it can make a difference for that whole year for your kid. So you don't want to rush to sign something like that.
So those are valid points. I do the same thing. And I tell them, I'm like, you can have an interpreter because we have a very diverse, you know, population here as well. And I always tell them, I'm like, you can ask for an interpreter of any language. And I think as like a lot of them, I will say, I think you need it because I think sometimes you're getting up in your emotions and then it gets hard to really go back and forth if you're bilingual or even if you don't maybe speak English that well. Mm-hmm. And then you get flustered and you're not going to understand or going to get too upset. Have an interpreter because they're going to go a little bit slower because they have to interpret for you. And it's going to take a little bit more time. So you have more time to process and maybe that diffuses a little bit of things too. So you're right. Knowing their rights to what they can and can have, you know.
Exactly. So yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's how all this started. And now we're here, you know, having crazy days every day.
Yeah. So I'm going to come to a close here. And then I want to ask, you know, a few more things, just one more question, actually. What do you want others to understand about the life after the breaking of your diagnosis?
What's very commonly said is you're not alone. Don't close your perception of what your life wasn't. You know, focus on more what you can do with your current situation. Stay as positive as possible. Don't let others tell you what your kid can and cannot do, as the parent know best for your child. And don't doubt yourself as an individual because you really don't realize what you're capable of until you're put in that situation. And I think from personal experience, I've grown so much since the diagnosis with my son and then later with my daughter that it's made me into a person that I can say I'm proud of. And I can see how my daughter specifically looks at me and she's proud of me. So definitely don't think a diagnosis is the end to all, you know, because it's not. It's just a beginning to a new situation that you now have to take over, but it comes with beautiful silver linings. My son, he's a very authentic individual, you know, and I wouldn't have otherwise, you know, and so is my daughter, you know, her empathy goes beyond words, you know, so yeah, I think that would be it.
I love that. I love that. And you know, what I say too is that you have the PhD in your child. You know them better than anyone else. You know, I was thinking about that too, because you were saying you brought all this paperwork in and you're like, what are you, a doctor, a teacher? Well, yeah, a PhD in my child. Yes. I hold that because you don't know it. You're meeting us for 10 minutes, you know?
Exactly.
You live it.
Hence why we create these podcasts, you know, to give that platform to these parents to actually share their story for once and not have to hear all these acronyms just be thrown at them, but actually express what they're really going through and not all the beautiful things, maybe the hard things that are hard to hear and process. And it's okay, you know, as a family, as an individual, you can just get through it with your child and things do get better.
They do. Thank you so much for joining us on this, you know, journey today, you know, of having a vulnerable conversation. And I hope it reminds you of taking a break at, you know, the end of this. And whether you're in the becoming at the beginnings of, you know, your diagnosis. And I want to say thank you, Carla. Thank you for being on the show today and showing such honesty and strength through your story.
Thank you, Ruth. Thank you. It was a pleasure, you know, and thank you for having me and sharing my story, allowing me to share my story.
Thank you. Your story is a light for so many, and your voice carries hope into places where words often fall short. If this episode spoke to you, please take a moment and share it with another parent, friend, or caregiver who might be standing there on their own breaking point. You never know how and what you share that someone else, it might be someone else's turning point. And if you unlock that community for them, don't forget to join us inside our Your Autism Journey Facebook group where you can also find more resources, episodes. As always, thank you for being here, and thank you for being brave, and remember, you're not alone. Until next time, stay grounded in grace.